Lord, I wonder if there's really anything else that we need to hear. You came as you were into our world so that we can come as we are to you and find life. That's why you've drawn us this morning. Needs we have, burdens we bear, sin we struggle with. In all this, you have come to free us from and give us an exchanged life because of what you did in entering our world and in dying and rising and ascending and sending the Spirit. You've given us life, and we long for that. So the people this morning, we'd like to come just as we are with all our brokenness and sin, all our wounds and disfigurement, and find in you what our souls long for. Find healing and health and life. Lord, I'm very sure that what your people need to hear this morning is not my words, but your words. I know that what will change their hearts is not what I will say, but what you will say through your word. I beseech you, I ask you, for Christ's sake, would you please open our hearts to your word so that we might become not in word only, but in deed and in living followers of the Son. We long to have this kind of life. Draw us then to be his followers. Use your word to transform us for our good and for your glory. I pray in his name. Amen. Well, let me offer my word of greeting to you also, those of you who either have had mothers or are mothers. Happy Sunday to you. I think that includes everybody, okay? Well, when you walk in, even into a place like this, even into a church like this, the truth is you came in with a measuring stick, a ruler, a standard. It is that measuring stick by which you evaluate and measure significance and greatness. You determine what you will do and how you will live. We determine who matters to us and how we will treat them based on this internal and almost unconscious yardstick that all of us carry around. You know, you might be reluctant to admit. You might say, well, I don't do that kind of thing. I don't have an internal kind of yardstick that I use to evaluate people. Well, let me just ask you a couple of questions. Who would you work for if you could? You have some preference there? I'd like to work for that person, not that person. How about who? Here you go, the parent. Who would you want your son or daughter to marry? Or not marry? You might not even be able to verbalize that, but you got some internal kind of criteria going on there. Who would you want if you were one of these high school students about to ship off to college? Who would you want as your roommate in college? Is there a preferred list? A not-so-preferred list? What would you like your parents to do or not to do? Who would you want to lead your team or your country? You see, there's those internal measuring stick. When you take your seat on the airplane, oh, this happens all the time. You take your seat on the airplane, there's an empty seat next to you, and you are watching the people come down the aisle, right? And what's going through your head? No! Oh, what's that? That's the internal yardstick kicking in. That's you're doing that evaluation. When you're new to school, you're sitting at your desk, the seats aren't assigned, people are just drifting in. What are you thinking? If someone's coming to fill that seat next to you. Yes! Or no, you know, there's the internal yardstick kicking in there. When you get a phone call on your cell phone and you look at the number, And then you go, nah. Or yeah, what are you doing? You're evaluating significance and meaning and purpose and worth and value based on your internal yardstick. You're looking at the number and saying yes or no based on what's going on the inside. We all have it. We assess. I assess, you assess what is valued, what matters, what you will give yourself to, how you will treat others on the basis of your internal and almost unconscious yardstick. And so the question facing us this morning is this: are you using the right standard? Have you evaluated your evaluator recently? I really think that's part of what Jesus is doing. That is what the question he's raising with his friends, those who are nearest and dearest to him. And that's what we will explore this morning. What he wants to do is draw them near and enfold them and invite them to experience the kind of life that he experiences. And that's where we are in our journey in Mark. Why Mark? If you've been here for a length of time, you know we've been in Mark for a while. Why Mark? Because the truth is, y'all want life. You all are desperate to experience real life. And real life is unavailable apart from the real Jesus. Not the Jesus of your own imagining. Not the popular cultural Jesus. This Jesus we meet in the pages of the Scriptures is the Jesus who offers us life. And so the reason why we're in the Gospel of Mark is because we want life, and it's found only in relationship with this Jesus. So we've been on a journey through the Gospel of Mark. We've been some 30 weeks into Mark so far, and we've come to a transition in the Gospel itself. Charlie helped us see, explain over the past couple of weeks that Mark chapter 8 is a transition point. When Peter makes his confession in Mark chapter 8, you are the Messiah. There's a change that comes in the Gospel. The change comes because it's a change that's reflected in Jesus' own ministry. Up till Peter's confession, Jesus was trying to make clear who he was. And when Peter and the disciples begin to get it, Jesus now changes what it is that he's offering. He now begins to explain, so now that you know who I am, let me tell you what I am about and what it will mean to follow me. So the first half of the Gospel, Jesus presents himself. The second half of the Gospel, he tells us what he's about and what it will mean to follow him. And that's where we're picking up, in that second half of the Gospel, picking up on what it will mean for us to be followers of Jesus. Now, I'm going to make an assumption here as I start this message, and that is that you all are interested in being followers of Jesus. I don't know you all personally, and I assume some of you came this morning because you really are interested in pursuing this life in Jesus, and some of you the Spirit just drew. You just weren't sure why you're here this morning, but the Spirit's drawing you because the Spirit's intention is that you be a follower of Jesus. And so I'm going to speak to all of us this morning as if that's really what matters most, being followers of Jesus. We're going to pick up in Mark chapter 9, coming off of, in a sense, the failure of the disciples. Charlie explored that with us last week when Jesus went up to the Mount of Transfiguration. When he came down, 9 disciples were at the foot of the mountain trying to help a demonized boy and his very desperate father, and they weren't able to. Jesus is able to, and out of that rich moment, Charlie helped us see that the way that needs are met and are addressed are not by having great faith, but by having your faith in a great object of faith. We tend to want to feel strong, Charlie explained, but it's really when we feel our weakness and feel our dependence on God that we really come to experience the kind of life he wants. And it is in that setting, out of that sense of weakness and out of that sense of having failed, that Jesus is intentionally teaching his disciples about what it means to continue to follow him. In a sense, Mark brings us a close-up down as Jesus spends some time with the 12. And that's where we're picking up in Mark chapter 9. Open up with me, if you would, to the 9th chapter of the Gospel of Mark. And I'm going to start reading in verse 30. It's perhaps a familiar passage, and there will be some statements here that you've heard before, but we want to hear them in a fresh way. So let's listen to what Mark has to tell us. They, Jesus and the disciples, they went from there and passed through Galilee. And Jesus did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. And when they had come to Capernaum, and he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he sat down and called the 12 and said to them, If anyone would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. And he took a child and put the child in the midst of them, and taking the child into his arms, Jesus said to them, Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me, and whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. Mark tells us they're passing through Galilee. That's a familiar place in the gospel. It's Jesus' hometown area. He grew up in that region. It's the starting point for his ministry, but he says he doesn't want anyone to know it. Why? Well, because, according to verse 31, he is teaching his disciples. The focus has moved from the broad ministry to the masses. Not that Jesus won't interact with them, but the concentration is now really on those who have started to buy into this life Jesus is offering, and now he's going to unpack for them more of what it means. And so he begins to explain to them, teach them. The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. That's interesting. It's not the first time that Jesus has mentioned his death. The first time was back in chapter 8, verse 31. Now in 9:31, he repeats it. But there is some comparison and contrast that needs to be noticed. Jesus is adding something to the picture. If you look just on the same page, probably, chapter 8, verse 31, Jesus began to teach his disciples that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. But now he's saying the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men and they will kill him. And when he is killed after 3 days, he will rise. Notice some difference here. In chapter 8, Jesus says that he's going to be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes. Chapter 9, he says he's going to be delivered into the hands of men. It's not just a Jewish thing. It's a humanity thing. Jesus' death is not just because of the problems with the Jewish people. It has to do with all of mankind. Jesus seems to be opening up the window there. And then in 8:31, he says that the Son of Man will be killed. Sounds like that's a possible outcome. 9:31, they will kill him. Wicked, serious, purposeful intent. Jesus is adding to the picture, helping them understand what's coming. And then you have to notice this single word, translated delivered in 9:31 in ESV, sometimes rendered betrayed. It's an interesting word. The Son of Man literally is being betrayed. Just using the tense to suggest that it's now ongoing. Is being delivered. And that word delivered is an interesting word. It appears first in in Mark chapter 1, verse 14. When John the Baptist is taken away into prison, he's delivered. It's not an accidental kind of word. It's sometimes used in the Old Testament, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It's sometimes used to talk about where God was working out his intentional plan in the life of a prophet or the priest or a king. The same word is used by Paul a couple of times, most notably in Romans, chapter 4 and chapter 8. Let me just read a couple of verses to you. Romans chapter 4, speaking of Jesus, Paul says, He was delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification. That's 4:25. What Paul's saying there is that God intentionally did this. The delivering up language is about God's work being accomplished through the Son. In Romans chapter 8, the same language comes up in verse 32, where Paul writes and says, He who did not spare his own Son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not also with him graciously give us all things? What does this mean? When Jesus says the Son of Man is being delivered up to men who will kill him, what Jesus is saying is this is not accidental. This is not a possible outcome. This is what God is sovereignly undertaking to do. I am being moved by the Father into this situation, and they will, in fact, kill me. It's a profound, huge statement. Jesus is saying that I am on this path by the Father's ordination, and I am being set to this end, to be killed by those into whose hands I will be delivered. I will enter out. I'll rise from the dead. Well, how did the followers of Jesus react to that statement? Verse 32 says, they did not understand the saying, and were afraid to ask him. Understand the saying, that's the only time that word appears in Mark. The only people who are ignorant, interestingly enough, in the Gospel of Mark are the disciples. Take heart. We should be encouraged by that. The only people who are, that's the word that's ignorant. The only people who are ignorant of what Jesus is doing is the disciples. They're defying there. They're told that they don't get it. It doesn't make sense to them. Like Charlie has been telling us, it doesn't make sense for them to understand how the Messiah could be delivered up. But it says, but they were afraid to ask him. Now, Charlie suggested last week that part of the reason why they might be hesitant to ask him is because of the rebuke that Jesus delivered when he came down from the Mount of Transfiguration. He says, unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? But I wonder if there's another facet to their fear, why they might not ask him. Back in chapter 8, verse 31, when Jesus first makes mention of his death, you remember what happens? Jesus says the Son of Man is going to be delivered up. And Peter goes, no way! I don't understand how that can happen. And what does Peter get for his questioning? He got rebuked. Get behind me, Satan. Then when they were coming down to the Mount of Transfiguration, another reference is made to Jesus' death. He doesn't explain it fully, but a reference is made, and the disciples are struggling with this Elijah moment. Shouldn't Elijah come before Messiah comes? And a couple weeks ago, Charlie walked us through that. But when the disciples are asking about Elijah, Jesus offers a very cryptic, troubling statement. He says Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they wanted. That wasn't a pretty picture. So the previous two mentions in chapter 8 of Jesus' death are followed by a lot more bad news. When Jesus first speaks about his death, and Peter raises the question, bad news. Get behind me, Satan. You are Satan. That's not a good exchange they have. And coming down from the mountain, when they ask about Elijah, they get this troubling statement that Elijah has come, and they did with him whatever they wanted. And the Son of Man is going to suffer also. And so I wonder if part of the disciples' thought is, apprehension is, all right, this is the next time he spoke about death. Let's not ask him anymore, because we don't want any more bad news. I don't want to ask him any more about this, because the more we ask about it, there's more stuff that I just don't want to hear. They can't seem to get their heads around what Jesus is talking about. But that doesn't mean they're not thinking. The truth is, they're thinking about something. Did you notice what they were thinking about? Let's notice what they are attentive to. Verse 33, they came into Capernaum, and when Jesus was in the house, he asked them, we'll be traveling through Galilee, get to the house. Guys, what were you discussing on the way? Were you talking about my being delivered up? Guys, were you talking about the why I would be getting killed? Guys, were you talking about what it means to rise from the dead? Guys, what were you talking about on the way? But they didn't answer. Because they had been arguing about who is the greatest. I wonder what started that. Do you think it might have started because the nine couldn't cast out the demons and the three came down and said, had we been here, maybe that was what started the argument about the greatest. Or maybe some of them heard the fact that Jesus was really talking about dying. And so now they're thinking, so if he's out of the picture, which one of us is... Well, we're not told what started the argument. But they start arguing about greatness. And we're not told exactly what that greatness means, but clearly, what do they want? They want to matter. They want significance. They want to be valued. And you know what's amazing? Jesus does not diss them for that. He doesn't look at them and go, you wicked bunch of disciples wanting to be great. He doesn't say that. He doesn't say how terrible it is for you to want greatness in the kingdom. He doesn't say that. You didn't hear what he says. They're arguing about greatness. And he calls them together and sits down. That's the posture of the teacher. He sits down and says, okay, if you want firstness, go for it. Just use the right yardstick to measure greatness. That's what Jesus is explaining to them. Wanting greatness is not the bad thing. Using the wrong yardstick is. Jesus says, if you want to be first, go for it. You want to be first, be first. But measure it the right way. Two ways. You're going to be first. You want a place of priority. You want greatness in the kingdom. You will have to be last of all. What does that mean? Last? Well, think of your young kids being released into the playground, racing with other children across to the swings. You hear them shouting, right? You hear any of them shouting, me last, me. Is that what they shout? No. Me first. Above others. In front of others. My two kids, now older, don't do this anymore. But when they were younger, I do remember us planning a family trip, going somewhere, leaving the house, and as we go out to the car, you hear one of them shout, shotgun! Place of priority! Never heard them shout, back seat! No one wants to be the low person on the totem pole. What does it mean to be last? It means to jockey for position that's lower rather than higher. He says you can have greatness, you can have significance, you can matter in the kingdom if you measure it right. It's lastness that matters. Not firstness, lastness that matters. And then he says it's serving. He says if anyone wants to be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. A couple of words in the New Testament that could be used to talk about serving. There's one that's enslaved. You don't have any choice, you just have to do it. That's a word for serving. There's a work for hire. You serve when you're paid for it. There's the serving that priests do that's dutiful, obligatory. This is the word for personal devotion, to do out of a willingness to do. Jesus is going to unpack this more as we move through the Gospel of Mark, but right here, you got to hear this. Jesus is talking to us, those who want to follow him, and saying, you can be first in the kingdom. You can have greatness. You can have significance. You can matter. You have to measure it right, though, when you measure it with lastness and servanthood. When the first exposition of Jesus' dying comes up, and the disciples struggle with that, Jesus begins to unpack it this way in chapter 8. I'm going to go back to chapter 8, verse 34. Calling the crowd to him, with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone, that's the same kind of introduction, if anyone wants to be first, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, for whoever would save his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake in the gospel will save it. Charlie unpacked that for us. I don't want to undo that. But I just want you to see that there's a momentum going. Jesus is talking about his death, and he's building on that. He's talking about what it means to follow him, and he's building on that. When he talks about cross, he doesn't say, if you're going to follow me, die. In fact, for most of us, that would be easier. Dying is easier than serving others. He doesn't say die. He says take up your cross and come. Keep on walking. What does it mean to take up your cross? That means life on your terms is over. And he didn't unpack that in chapter 8, but now he's unpacking it in chapter 9. You know what it means to not have life on your terms? It means to pursue lastness and servanthood. What does it mean to take up your cross? It means to join Jesus in his kind of life. What kind of life does he live? Lastness, servanthood. This is an upside down kind of living. Life not on your terms, not on my terms. What does it look like? It looks like lastness and serving, and not to embrace that life. To not embrace lastness and servanthood means you will not experience the kind of life Jesus offers you. If you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. Unless you enter into this kind of life, you won't find life. And then Jesus pictures what he was trying to tell them in chapter 9. He takes a child, puts the child in the midst of them, and grabs the child in his arms and says, whoever receives one such as this receives me, and whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. What is Jesus saying? he's not, at that point, he's not telling the disciples to be childlike. There are other places in the Gospels where he talks about that. The child here is not the model. Jesus is the model. Jesus embraces a child. So what's so big significant about that? In that culture, in that day, in that age, children were throwaways. They were unvalued, depreciated. They couldn't contribute anything to you. They couldn't add to you. And so they didn't have value until they became old enough to do something worth. So when Jesus is trying to picture for them what this lastness looks like, what this servanthood looks like, it's the embracing of someone who can do nothing for you, who benefits you not at all, who can contribute nothing to your status, nothing to your business, who brings no benefit other than you have an opportunity to live like Jesus lives. So pulling it all together, Jesus is speaking to his disciples and says, I'm going to be treated like a nobody. When he talks about his death, that's what he's saying. They're going to treat me like a last one. I'm going to be delivered over and killed in order to serve those I came to save. And when Jesus says that, the disciples start arguing about how they can get greatness in the kingdom, and Jesus welcomes that. Come on, you can have greatness too. But it's going to have to be my kind of greatness, because the truth is, Jesus has no other life to invite you into. Do you understand that? Jesus' life is the life of a last one and a servant. And he says, come have life. What other life will he offer you? He has no other life to invite you into than into this life of lastness and servanthood, because that's his life. And if we enter into that kind of life, then we experience his kind of life. There's no other life to offer you. So if you follow him, that is the kind of life he's welcoming you into. We can have greatness in the kingdom if we measure it with the right yardstick. So I've been thinking, what will it be like to be last in my life? What will it be like to be last in your life, in our world, to be servant of all? I am, of course, rather selective in my serving. I like to serve particular people, those that I know will be able to return some benefit to me. I like to be pick and choose who I will serve and how I will serve them, as long as it will bring me the greatest maximum benefit. And Jesus says that invite me to that kind of life. He says, Brian, take up your cross. Life on your terms is over if you're going to follow me, and that will mean you will be the last of all and the servant of all. What might that look like? Well, kids, what about your parents? When they treat you like you are in their home merely to do the chores that they don't want to do, how do you respond? Do you push back against that? Do you resist that? Or do you see this as an opportunity to become last and servant? You don't mean the servant thing you're supposed to be having at home, do you? It can't happen out there with... Well, if you want to experience the life of Jesus in your home, you know what? I guess you'll have to have life on Jesus' terms in your home. Parents, what about your children? Relating to them, when they act as if you are merely the endless source of wealth and provision, and they gladly take all your care and support with nary a thank you, and then you start to think, I'm done with that. I'm not doing that anymore. What is going through your mind? This is not getting me anywhere. Oh. You want to be somewhere else other than last? I'm just being treated as a servant. You wanted something other than Jesus' life? If you're not experiencing it in your home, maybe it's because you haven't really decided to follow Jesus in that relationship. What about your coworkers? When you're assigned or partnered with someone and you know, you just know your experience and expertise is going to help, and the project is going to go well, and that person's never going to reciprocate. They're never going to give back to you. You're never going to get return. What will you do? How will you respond? As boss, when you're relating to your boss and you do all that he asks you to or all that she asks you to, and she takes all the credit, he gets all the credit, he gets the raise, you get nothing, what starts going through your mind and heart? Yes. What else? I get to serve. If that's not going through your mind and heart, then you are not understanding Jesus' invitation to life. And then you wonder, why is life so miserable and hard and difficult? Because you want life on your terms, not on Jesus' terms. What about with your spouse? When you do all that you are asked to, but he or she doesn't reciprocate. After years of giving, you still don't feel that he appreciates you or that she recognizes you, doesn't return to you the love that you feel like you're giving, takes everything that you give and gives nothing in return. What do you do at that moment? You go, that's not what I signed up for. What did you sign up for? What did you sign up for? Did you sign up to get first place? Did you sign up for your spouse to serve you? Or did you sign up to experience Jesus' life in this relationship? And are you working towards last and servant of all? Or how about others in the church where you've extended yourself and you've given and you've loved and you've served and nobody gives back to you? And you look around and go, that's a raw deal. No one's treating you the way that you've been treating others. Well, candidly, you know what? The one who was the servant of all would probably get no recognition. Nobody would pay much attention to them. Like a good waiter, the best of the waiters that serve at your tables, they're the ones who you don't notice. We can tell whether you really are interested in lastness and servanthood, because when you get treated like last and you get treated as a servant, if you rejoice in it, you're finding life with Jesus. If you don't, I'm not talking about submitting to physical abuse, although Jesus did. And certainly I'm not inviting you to sign up for masochism, but I am talking about actually prizing, valuing, and coming to see the importance of running for last place and excelling at serving. Most of us, in those relationships that are difficult, it is not because we're being abused. It is just because we're not high enough on the totem pole. It's not because we're being abused. It's because we're just the one serving. No one's serving us. But Jesus came to give his life for those who were alienated from God so that they could be restored and turn again. And they rejected him and opposed him and killed him. Jesus got treated as the last. And Jesus gives himself the servant to all. And the life he offers us is that life only. He has no other life to offer us. But it is the life of blessing. Jesus' life is the life of blessing. And if you seek any other kind of life, you won't find life. Any of you could long for and seek and attain a first place position in the kingdom. Greatness is possible if you only measure it the way Jesus does. If we think that what matters was being last rather than being a leader, if what we think mattered was serving rather than being served, then we would begin to experience Jesus' life. I came across an account of someone who seemingly has been measuring life the right way, pursuing lastness and servanthood. I'm not going to suggest that all of us will end up in the dire situation that Pastor de Gaulle found himself in, but I need to share with you his story. This comes from persecution.com, the Voice of the Martyrs website. Pastor François de Gaulle was a Christian for more than 50 years, and he was one of the few believers living in the small village of San Karakahol in Orissa State, India. He was well known by the Hindus who shared his neighborhood. His family lived there in relative peace. That is until August 24, 2008, when Hindu radicals began violent attacks against Christians throughout Orissa. Venomous threats by agitators forced the de Gaulle family to leave their village. Kapul, Pastor de Gaulle's wife, said, "They told my husband, you better leave, that he should leave his house and go away if he wanted to stay a Christian, because they were not going to allow any Christians to stay in our village." Well, the brutality against the Orissa Christians spawned by Hindu fundamentalists was unflinchingly complete. Homes were burned, churches destroyed, people were killed. The entire Degal family fled their small village in the Kandahar district to the slums and fled to the slums of the state's capital. All eight members were forced to live in a one-room wooden shack. About a month after they were driven out, Pastor Degal left his family in their makeshift shelter and decided to head back to his village to check on his people and his home. Pastor Degal was traveling on a local bus to his destroyed village when it was stopped by 18 Hindu radicals. What happened next was a horror unimaginable. The radicals dragged Pastor Degal off the crowded bus. They ignored the sound of the crunch of the bones as they broke both his legs. And then they proceeded to torture him there in the street, demanding that he return to Hinduism. "I am a strong believer in Jesus Christ," Pastor Degal said. "You may kill me, but I will not become a Hindu." So the 18 men began to beat Pastor Degal. They tied his hands and legs. Witnesses watched as they stripped him of his clothes, leaving nothing but a shirt. They set fire to his face and tortured him in unspeakable ways. Then they dumped his limp body in a creek where it floated for days. And his son talked about it. "I do not carry anger towards them, because my Jesus was once also killed on the cross for all mankind, for the entire sinful world. My father dedicated his life for my village, for people who still do not know Christ. I think for my village, my father also was killed. And by the sacrifice of his own life, they may know Jesus Christ and accept him as their only Lord and personal Savior." Pastor Degal was running for last place. Pastor Degal understood following Jesus was being servant of all. And we complain about such little mistreatment we receive at the hands of others and wonder, why am I not experiencing life with Jesus? Because if you want greatness, come. If you want to follow me, come. If you want significance, come. Measure it by my life. It's measured in lastness. It's measured in servanthood. Will you follow? Will you come? Let's pray. I want to give you just a minute. I know, because I know my own soul, I know the souls of many here, that there have been places where you've been measuring greatness and significance entirely wrong. You've had the wrong yardstick in relationship with your kids, in relationship with your parent, in relationship with your spouse or co-workers or people in the church. You have not prized lastness. You haven't prized servanthood. And it's right there that you are not experiencing Jesus' kind of life. Would you talk to him about that right now? Would you repent, turn away from life on your terms, and invite him to lead you into life on his terms? Because there you will taste life. Talk to him about that. Jesus, I know in a community like this, there are parents and children who are at odds. That there's chaos and trouble in their home, and part of it is due to the fact that the parents want this kind of honor that they especially deserve. And the children want a place of priority and significance that nobody wants to serve. And the families, they're not experiencing your life. And I pray that you would speak a word to the hearts of those souls, and a fresh experience of life would come.
I know that there are some work situations where a sense of tension and stress because I just can't do it, and what I can't do is give up life on my terms. The truth is I could. And so, Lord, would you speak a word to that soul, that heart,
inviting them to lastness and servanthood. For married couples, Lord, that are at odds, where one insists, I'm not getting what I deserve. Another insists I'm not being treated the way I should be treated. And neither of them are thinking about lastness or servanthood. Would you speak a word of life into those couples? And for those Christians sitting in this place who can't get along with the person on the far side of the congregation because they felt they'd been wronged or not valued or not appreciated or not treated right, would you dispossess us of all our wrong thinking about greatness and draw us into lastness and servanthood? Just so that we can taste life with you afresh. Do this, I ask, for our good, but more than that, for the spread of your fame and for your glory, so that people could see you and see us. This is what I ask. In Christ's great name.